Yeah, well, he's going to tell us all about why cosmology, or he's going to ask us why, whether in cosmology, whether it has three theory.
Okay, did the lights fry? Can anyone hear me?
I can hold that
a little bit. Is my voice actually passing through the microphone, or are you just hearing
I think it's going into the recording.
It's
okay. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, it's off, so that's it.
So what I wanted to do today is I'm actually talking about something that I've been working on for several years, one way or another. Primarily with Brian Green, Will Kinney, who I believe is me at Columbia, Gary Shrew, who's visiting Perimeter this semester and is in the audience today, and then most recently with Hiranya Pierce, who is primarily focused on extracting information from observational data about the universe, and so it's kind of bringing a different set of talents to this team of people. And so, I mean, obviously one of the things that we know is that what we see in the sky when we're thinking in terms of inflation is in some ways a product of physics that happened very, very early on in the universe, you know, very soon after the Big Bang, and potentially, at least by any other standard of physics that we usually think about, very, very close to the Planck scale. And on top of that, string theory has an extra scale, this Zöckler string scale, so as well as the Planck scale, you can worry about this extra scale. And it may be that you know, stringy physics are happening just a couple of orders, that inflation is happening just a couple of orders below the new scale that is introduced either at very, very high energy. And so it's one of the few ways in which we're really looking at, when we do cosmology, we're really looking at phenomena that, while they're not actually happening at these scales, at least happening near these scales. And so just naively, you'd think that cosmology is potentially providing you with a window that you can use to look into physics that's happening at scale. But in any other, almost any other form of terrestrial experimentation we might think of doing, would simply be completely inaccessible. So obviously asking the question, can cosmology test string theory, is a very interesting question to ask. And then of course, you can't simply ask that question in a vacuum. You have to actually think of different mechanisms you can use to do that and see if you can get some information out. And we've been focusing in particular on the way in which the existence of an extra minimum or an extra fundamental length in physics may change the way that we understand the generation of perturbations during in cosmology. So then we're going to see later on what happens is during inflation, very, very small length scales in the primordial universe are stretched to the point where they're now as big as the distance between galaxies, or indeed as big as the current horizon size, the current size of the visible universe. And so we want to see whether that kind of cosmological microscope that lets us do astronomical observations on a larger scale and encode physics that was happening in very, very short length scales in the early universe, whether we can use that to provide some sort of leverage about the way that string theory may have influenced the early universe. And the way we're going to do that is by looking at the generation of perturbations during inflation and seeing whether stringy effects have any impact on that. So in a sense, the question, can string theory, can cosmology test string theory, in some ways I want to boil us down to three somewhat more technical questions. And so the first question is, well, do we really understand the generation of cosmological perturbations? The standard treatment of this topic ignores any minimum length, either from the string scale or from the Planck scale. And so if we put this minimum length, this extra length in, that changed the analysis in a way that completely really standard inflation itself. And the answer to that is, yes, we really do understand the generation of perturbations and cost in inflation, at least to the 1% level. So the next question, well, if we understand things to the 1% level, do we actually understand things to the to arbitrary precision? Is there any way that we can slip in a change that won't completely mess things up, but on the other hand, will still be potentially predictable? And the answer to that question is maybe. I'm going to show that there's a region of parameter space where it's at least conceivable that these extra effects would have some impact on the perturbation spectrum, which would be large enough to observe, but on the other hand, not so big that it completely ruins everything that we're doing. And so the last answer to the question was, can we really see Planck scale physics with this so-called cosmological microscope? And the answer to that is going to be if we're lucky. Because while the answer to the second question is maybe yes, it's feasible that that there isn't an observable impact, the size of that effect is obviously going to depend on which part of parameter space we're living in. And it turned out that the lucky part of this means that the universe has to be kind to us in a sense. We actually have to be living in the piece of parameter space where this effect is maximized. It's very, very easy, even if this even if this effect is there, it's very, very easy to choose the parameters that describe our physical universe in such ways we'll never be able to pull the signal out of the CMB, even if it turns out to be there. So this, in some sense, is the punchline to my talk. And so the next 55 minutes is going to be spent the delivering of the details.
Doesn't that mean that you're
going
to change your answer to the first question
from yes to maybe? On the 1% level, I mean, in broad terms, we fully understand how the perturbation, the calculation of perturbations during inflation is safe.
But I would have said that you say that there's a price that's some level of category theory of error to understand.
Right.
If that's true, then the errors in the variance side are as big as
I guess what I'm thinking of is that there's nothing we've been able to find in the question in the top one that's going to affect things at zero order. So in other words, everything we're talking about here is a kind of perturbation to a small perturbation to what you see from inflation. And so the broad picture we get from inflation is safe, and certainly the level of any observation we've been able to do today. The question is there any signal in there at all that's going to mess things up? So it's sort of a perturbation to the perturbation.
I think there's this paper, the Poisson group, that argues that, and there are also other people who argue that upscale effects can explain this depression of power on the long wavelength mode, which is not a one percent group, those appear, the capacity to be just not there.
Right.
And so.
So. It's certainly possible to think of ways in which you can use, I mean, people have a lot of papers on using effects like this to explain this in a simple way. We're going to show the WMAP spectrum later on, so we may be better time to come back to this then. But I mean, as people are probably familiar, the quadrupole in some sense is missing from the CMB spectrum. It looks like this in L space, it looks like there's a suppression. And if you look at that in K space, the suppression is actually a lot stronger. It looks like there's basically a sharp cutoff in the spectrum. And so one of the things that people have been doing is using kind of analogous arguments to what I'm talking about here to suppress these modes. That's kind of a different problem, I think. I mean, I don't think what I'm saying here is, I think it's sufficiently different from what I'm saying here for that to be a different physics. I'm not sure that I believe it requires very strong tuning for that effect to actually work.
If it's in the realm of possibility, doesn't that mean that the order one effects are up for grabs?
I think you can probably have it either way. I'm content with the way that I put it. I think the problem with what the Poisson people have done is it requires very, very tight fine tuning in order to get a workable inflationary model that's still, I mean, that they need to arrange for the cutoff to appear at a very particular portion of the spectrum.
They're saying this is generic, but I'm
not sure that I believe that.
Even if it's doing, that means that it's possible.
Well, maybe we'll interrupt you if it's
no, go right ahead.
Maybe there must be hypothesis of quantum boundary theories and no one through the string theory that have a fundamental length. They all have a fundamental
length.
Around the fact that.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do you, what is the signature that tells you this comes to the string theory?
We'll get to that actually. Yeah, that's coming. So what I want to do today is I want to talk in reasonably broad outline so people can see what the major issues are here rather than get dug into specific calculations. And it turns out, in fact, that the calculations aren't particularly hard. They're all in the same. But I'm going to start just by reminding us of a couple of basic facts about the microwave background. And then how it is that the perturbations are actually laid down during inflation. So where the kind of slightly dodgy part of the argument might be and how this so-called cosmological microscope works. Then it's going to give an argument that's based on dimensional analysis that lets us establish how big we might expect this effect to be. And then we're going to look at a particular model or a particular answer for putting a minimum length into this calculation. It's certainly not the only one, but it's a particular way of introducing a minimum length when we can go and test. So my intention is to treat this particular calculation not as kind of be all and end all, but simply as a kind of case study for what it is if we could actually do this calculation in some quantum gravity theory, whether it's string theory or something else, from soup to nuts, then we wouldn't have to have any answers to put in a minimum length. But no one really knows how to do this calculation, and so we're forced at some point to say, well, we're just going to have to, we're going to introduce this by hand, and we're going to see what happens. And we're not saying that the particular form of the spectrum that we get out of that is is the form, and but we do believe that its overall features are probably representative of what you would expect to see. And then, having done that though, I can then see, well, what does that do to the power spectrum, and how do we go about then extracting that signal from a CMB dataset, particularly one that's cosmic variance limited out to some very large value of L. In other words, not the sort of dataset we'd even expect from, you know, 6 years of WMAP, but the sort of dataset that we'd expect from Planck or the successor to Planck. And that's going to let me point sort of hard limits for how observable these effects will be, not just in the future, but even in principle, because they're limited in the end by cosmic variance. And so just a reminder, this is a picture on the microwave background. This one was taken from Kobe. As you all know, the microwave background was discovered by accident in 1965 by a couple of guys working for a telephone company. And every point in the sky appears miraculously to be at roughly the same temperature. And it's almost a perfect black body spectrum. So just bear in mind that this is WMAP, and as we go to the next slide, the previous one was Kobe, this is WMAP. And so you can immediately see that there's hugely more detail in the second picture than there was in the first picture. In the end, it's an image of the same thing, but WMAP is able to observe the sky at much higher resolution, and therefore there's more information in this image and more precision that we can pull cosmological parameters out of it. And of course, in the future, Planck is going to go one better, and CMB Pol or whatever the successor mission to Planck is going to go one step better than that. So there's vastly more data that can be pulled out of the CMB than we've done so far. And we know, we know that inflation tells us that the natural explanation for these variations in temperature that we see across the sky, that the origin of these things in the end is that quantum fluctuations are generated during inflation. In the end, seed density perturbations in the primordial universe, which we then observe as temperature perturbations when we look at the microwave background. And so, in the end, one of inflation is famous for, in some sense, the one it became famous for, was that it provides for the first time a good mechanism for explaining why it is that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. But the point is, when we actually look at the sky, we're not observing, in some sense, its homogeneity and isotropy. That's a kind of DC term that we sort of subtract before we actually do anything. What we're actually observing when we look at the CMB, when we look at galaxies, is we're observing departures from homogeneity and isotropy. And the truly wonderful thing about inflation is it not just predicts that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, in other words, get the kind of zero-order solution for the universe right, but it also predicts that the universe will, in fact, depart from homogeneity and isotropy. And each model of inflation predicts a different set of departures from the others. And so it's actually by looking at not the kind of zero-order result, that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, but by looking at the first-order corrections to that result that inflation predicts, that we really go about testing different inflationary models. And it turns out that the these perturbations, we understand them as having a quantum mechanical origin. We normalize them at very early times in the universe using standard Bose Einstein statistics. And then using classical equations of motion, we propagate those perturbations out to very large scales. And then it's their values at very large scales that become the seeds for the structure that we see in the microwave background and in galaxy clusters. So this is this calculation, or the sequence of calculations, is a well understood process that by and large it makes use of physics that is well established and well taught, and it's essentially in some sense an applied science. And so the key thing where we're going to really push in on this is in the way in which the very initial state for these perturbations is set, because it's going to turn out that in order to set the initial state for these perturbations, we're talking about physics that's happening potentially at length scales that are much, much smaller than the Planck length. And obviously, if we're simply looking at something that's propagating in an Einstein background, then in order to have an Einstein background, we can't really be talking about it in ways that involve slicing it up beyond some finite length scales. There's some point at which that background is going to break down. And so just to remind you that in almost any cosmological spacetime, one has a so-called horizon. And in cosmology, the horizon is synonymous largely with the Hubble length. And the Hubble length is something you can measure at a time. It's just 1 over h, the expansion rate of the universe. And h is roughly proportional to the square root of the density. And so in the case of something that's expanding as the superspace of horizon, the 1 over h horizon, actually reduces to the future lifetime. But in practice, in most cosmological models, they're slightly different from each other. So during inflation, the co-moving size of the Hubble horizon is decreasing. In other words, the piece of the co-moving universe that an observer in an inflationary universe can see is continually getting smaller. In other words, pieces of the universe that you could see early on are continually leaving the region that one can meaningfully detect. So the perturbations have a fixed co-moving length. I mean, that's easy to understand because you take some wave and you draw it on the universe, and you make that universe bigger, the number of peaks and troughs is going to stay constant as the universe expands. In other words, its co-moving length is going to stay constant, but as its physical length gets bigger. And so what happens is that any given fluctuation with any given wavelength is going to start off much smaller than the cosmological horizon during inflation. And eventually it's going to get stretched to the point where it's much bigger than the cosmological horizon. And so once the perturbations leave the horizon, you can't tell that you're looking at a perturbation as opposed to something that simply lifted your kind of zero, you know, the zero order solution for your universe sort of up or down slightly. Because you can't see the if you look at any wave on a small enough piece, that wave is going to look simply like a constant change in the background. And so the longer scales, the second thing we know is that the longest scales will leave the horizon earliest. In other words, the scales that correspond to the structure that's equivalent to the current size of our universe must have left the horizon earlier than scales that correspond to, say, size of a typical galaxy today. And this is simply something that follows from the geometry of inflation. Once inflation ends, of course, the Hubble length increases, and the perturbations are then free to re-enter the horizon, and it's these perturbations that provide the seeds for the formation of galaxies and for the temperature and isotropies we observe in the microwave background. So looking at this perturbation generation, this is again a cartoon of what I sketched before. So the lines are created well inside the horizon, and you have this little wiggle there, and then the horizon is decreasing while the mode, co-moving size of the horizon is decreasing while the mode stays constant. And so eventually when the two things match each other, you see that the horizon size and the mode wavelength are about the same. And then by the end of inflation, the mode is much, much smaller than the horizon. And so that, this ends any possibility of the mode evolving, it falls away, so the mode is simply frozen. And after inflation, of course, the horizon is getting bigger and the mode then re-enters the horizon. So we're now in a position to talk about this. And again, sort of moving very quickly in a kind of qualitative way, we've got a calculation that lets us say what it is that these primordial modes are going to influence the microwave background. And on the other hand, we've got observations of the microwave background that we can extract the spectrum from. And so the point at which one collides theory and observation, and one eventually works out the spectrum for a given choice of universe, which is going to depend both on what you assume about the primordial spectrum of perturbations, but also the stuff you put inside the universe, which affects how they evolve as a function of time. And then you can compare those two things, the W in that case and the what we see on the sky. And I think that the point that was alluded to before, the fact that that these points here are much lower than you would expect them to be, corresponds to this cutoff at large wavelengths, or in this map, this picture, very small values of L. And so this is currently the best data set for the CMB that's currently available. And one of the truly beautiful things about it is you can see that the fit of the theory is actually remarkably good, other than some anomalous points there. But in general, the points that you see there are actually the points including the error bars. In other words, and even when you put the error bars on, it doesn't actually make the points any bigger, certainly out to about this region here. So we really do understand the physics of the CMB. It would seem in some detail in order to be able to fit this fairly complicated curve with a fairly small number of parameters. And so in order to make a theoretical prediction, we have to start with some prediction for the primordial spectrum of perturbations, which is what we're going to extract from inflation. And we feed this prediction into a code like CMBFast, which, I mean, it's nothing magical. It's simply a way of kind of summarizing all of the physics of the early universe and evolving it forwards in time that uses nice numerical techniques, so you don't have to, you can get the answers in a few minutes. And so we have to predict other numbers, such as the current baryon fraction of the universe, in other words, the number of protons and neutrons, and also electrons, which if you're a cosmologist, are included amongst the baryons. The amount of dark matter, which is what's providing essentially the gravitational potential that we understand leads to the formation of galaxies. We have to predict we get the present value of the Hubble constant, because the way that these things evolve depends on how fast the universe is expanding. Having a cosmological constant, that again has an impact on the way that the perturbations evolve, and you have to include that. If you're having a spatial curvature in the universe, obviously that has to go in somewhere. And so typically what one does is when you actually come to specify the underlying spectrum, you don't specify a particular inflationary model, you just specify the output of that inflationary model. In other words, you specify the initial spectrum of curvature perturbations or density perturbations, which is pretty much the same thing, as some as an amplitude times k to raise to n, the so-called spectral index minus 1. And it turns out, in order to get a roughly scale-free spectrum, in other words, so that you don't have a kind of, the spectrum doesn't blow up either on a very short scale or a very large scale, you need this quantity n minus 1 to be pretty close to 0. In other words, that each value of k that you assess the spectrum for has essentially the same power as every other one. On the other hand, we know that the limit where this n is exactly 1, where the spectrum is exactly scale independent, corresponds to the Sitter space. And the problem with doing inflation in the Sitter space is that you have to end inflation somehow. And in the Sitter space, because the Sitter space is time translation invariant, it means that you've got no way for the different pieces of the universe at the end of inflation to tell each other that now it's time for us all to end inflation at the same time. And if inflation ends at very different times in different pieces of the universe, you'll see a very inhomogeneous universe at the present time. So typically what happens is you have to find some way of putting some sort of clock into theory to tell all of the inflationary domains at the end of inflation that we're all going to end inflation right now. And so in the case of new inflation, or models of inflation where you have a continuously varying scalar field, that's very easy to do because all of the scalar fields, all of the different domains of the scalar field reaches the bottom of the potential at much the same time. However, when you do that, it turns out that in any universe apart from the Sitter space, you're going to find that the spectrum of perturbations is not exactly scale invariant. And that's going to correspond to the fact that as the inflaton field rolls slowly in its potential, the value of H is in fact changing. In other words, H, which is constant in the Sitter space, is very, very slowly varying during the average, during any realistic model of inflation in order to provide this plot. And so what that means is that we can think of, when we come to actually do this calculation, we can calculate the behavior of any given mode. We can imagine to a first approximation that it lives in the Sitter space, and then we can slowly dial the parameter H that describes how fast the Sitter space is expanding. We can slowly decrease that parameter as we consider consecutive modes, and that's what gives us the scale dependence of the spectrum. So typically, the inflationary spectrum is changing slowly enough so that we can describe the spectrum with just two parameters, the slope n minus 1 and the amplitude at some caducial value of k. And then on top of that, we have to add the so-called tensor modes. And the scalar modes correspond to actual density perturbations that change from place to place, where the field value changes from place to place during inflation. The tensor modes, on the other hand, are simply the spin through part of the perturbation to the metric. And these guys don't actually couple directly to structure. In other words, the tensor modes don't contribute to the growth of structure in the universe in the way that the scalar modes do. And you can actually calculate the expected amplitude of tensor modes fairly quickly, and you can show that the amplitude of those tensor modes is simply proportional to h, the value of the Hubble constant during, or h squared, in fact, value of the Hubble constant during inflation. And so because h is slowly changing during inflation, again, you expect to see some scale dependence in the spectrum of tensor modes. And it's actually, you can actually go one step further, and you can actually look at, you can actually show that in simple models of inflation, the ratio of the tensor modes to the scalar modes is actually connected to the spectral indices of the tensor modes and the scalar modes. So in fact, you've got potentially four observational parameters, but only three independent numbers. So the interesting thing about what we're going to be doing here is that almost any inflationary model is in fact specified in terms of just this k-dependence and potentially the next to leading order dependence. In other words, the so-called running of the running, the dn d log k. But in fact, the effect that we're considering is something that modifies the underlying spectrum. In other words, all of the physics in the later universe stays is unchanged, but the initial conditions are going to change. The thing that we put in is the initial seed for these perturbations. And so in that sense, as a theoretical model, it's actually fairly unusual in almost all of the ways that people have thought of messing up the perturbation spectrum, almost always different ways of putting changing the evolution of these modes, not in terms of changing the generation of them. So what I want to do now is simply to walk through a kind of dimensional analysis argument to show how it is that these scales work in inflation, and then why it is that it might be reasonable that we'd expect to see some sort of effect from including this minimum length. So inflation has to occur at the gut scale a lot. The reason that's true is that because, as I just said, the amplitude of the tensor modes is a function of the energy density during inflation. We can constrain the amplitude of the tensor modes from measurements that we've already done at the microwave factor. So there's an upper limit on that amplitude. There's no observation of them, but there's an upper limit. And that upper limit says that we can't have an inflationary scale that's significantly higher than the gut scale. On the other hand, there's no lower bound. It's entirely conceivable that inflation, if you're lucky, could have happened at, say, the TeV scale, in which case the tensor mode is suppressed by a factor of, you know, 10 to the 3 over 10 to the 15 relative to where the upper bound is. And in that case, we'll never ever see them, no matter how sophisticated we've become, at least by looking at the microwave factor. We also know that after inflation, the universe has, we have to take the energy out of the inflaton field, and we have to turn that into particles, you know, that correspond to the stuff that we see in the universe. In other words, stuff that's typically going to be relativistic, so we can think of it as radiation. And this is a so-called reheating process. And if you imagine the reheating as prompt, then that's telling you that the reheating temperature is going to be on the order of the energy scale of inflation. In other words, can again be around 10 to the 15 GeV, or potentially lower. On the other hand, the tip plane temperature is 10 to the 19 GeV, and we have a length associated with that, which is just one of the two planes. So this is nothing remarkable here, just a dictionary that lets us take us between a temperature specified in GeV and a temperature specified in Kelvin. So the fact we know that the universe is around 10 to the 10 light years across, or the visible piece of the universe, which is about, to say, 10 to the 61 times L Planck, given that the current temperature of the universe is 2.7 kelvins, in a very rough guess, we can say that the amount of growth that's happened in the universe since the end of inflation to the present day is simply the ratio of the temperature at the end of inflation over the temperature today, which is equal to approximately 10 to the 28. On top of that, we know that the longest perturbations had to grow by a factor of around e to the 60 during inflation. This comes from getting the homogeneity and isotropy of the universe nailed down. So you get e to the 60, which is 10 to the 26. You see a factor of 10 to the 26 during inflation, factor of 10 to the 28 afterwards. That's telling you that the total growth of the universe since the largest modes of the universe left the horizon has to be at least 10 to the 54. Now, bearing in mind that the Planck scale is only 10 to the 61, that's telling you that long scales are almost always sub-Planckian. You only have to have an extra 7 orders of magnitude growth during inflation over the minimal amount that you need. And remember that, in fact, inflation can give you almost infinite amount of growth. So to not have those 7 orders of magnitude would imply a stringent extra tuning on your inflationary model. It's telling you that almost any inflationary model, the length scales that now correspond to galaxies and indeed to the scale of the universe, those scales were smaller than the Planck scale during inflation. And so that may not seem like a problem, because obviously, some scale was smaller than the Planck scale at some point if you work backwards in the history of the universe. But it's going to become a problem when we look at the calculation of the perturbation spectrum. And so this is the next issue. So we want to say, well, okay, we've got this.
Empiricism phases up inflation, as you have pointed out in the beginning of the paper. The number of total equalities would be smaller.
Yeah.
Such a problem.
The total number of equalities can be smaller than that if you do anything that lowers the reheating temperature is essentially what we did in some ways was have a reheat temperature that was very low. So it's certainly possible to weaken this argument in that way and to avoid it. On the other hand, if you're just writing down a random model of inflation, you expect the naive expectation is that it's a scale. I should put some of that. And so everything that I'm saying here is not what has to happen. It's simply this is in some ways the most likely region of model space to be living in. Well, certainly there's no reason to exclude it. And so what the final answer is going to be is that the result that we're going to see is going to be it's on the slide. We expect that the effect of the impact of adding a minimum length is going to be the energy scale of inflation divided by whatever that new energy scale is. And so if you set the energy scale of inflation very low, then you're never going to see any of these effects. On the other hand, there's no a priori reason to do that. I mean, assuming true that I've written down a model where that's exactly what happens, but I've also looked at models where that's the exact opposite of what happens. And so it's going to turn out that there's a region of parameter space where you don't have to worry about this effect, and there's another region of parameter space where you do, and that's what gets back to, like, if we're lucky, we're living in a region of parameter space where you can see this and you can actually do this test. But if it turns out that you don't see the signal, then simply it's not going to rule anything out. It just simply rules out a piece of the parameter space that we might be living in. And so in general, that's true of almost any observational constraint for signal. So the question is, well, does this extra minimum length have, or does this fact that the scales in the universe can be smaller than the Planck scale at some finite time in the universe's past, does this have any observational consequences? And so let's just, for the moment, not assume a Planck scale, but assume just some fundamental mass scale. And so quantum gravity, that fundamental scale, is going to be the Planck scale. It's going to be 10 to the 19 GeV. But the string scale, in a lot of theories, a lot of string theory models, is in fact a couple of orders of magnitude below that. And in fact, in answer to John's question, this is the one way that string theory really enters this theory, is that in string models, it's reasonable that this new scale is in fact lower than the Planck scale. And that is going to mean that in string models, rather than kind of pure quantum gravity models, we'd expect this effect to be stronger. So it's not, I mean...
Well, in quantum gravity models, the length between the finite gravity is not fixed.
No. You can, the lower you put the scale, the closer it has to be to the inflationary scale, the stronger the effect gets. To say that the natural scale of quantum gravity is the Planck scale is simply just being conservative. You're welcome to put it lower. Yeah, you can put it lower if you want, and if you put it lower, we'll be happy to.
You still get a finite quantum gravity.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
It's also true that it doesn't have to be quantum gravity, but any kind of...
There's possibly more than one scale of new physics as you work your way up past the gut scale. And whatever, in a sense, we're running into the first, whatever the lowest scale is, it means that you can't talk about a background space time as well described by Einstein gravity. It's the scale that we're concerned about.
It's also true that if you should see something as below the Planck scale, it doesn't mean you saw string theory.
It just means you see something, yeah. So in this sense, the string part of this, because no one's been able to do this calculation ab initio inside of string theory and work out what the correction actually is, it means that this, at the moment, we're not truly testing string theory. It's, as I said, it's a case study rather than a detailed calculation. I mean, we want to be very clear about that, about the claims that we make.
Since we derailed you, I mean, you already mentioned another scale, the gut scale.
Yeah. That's
an interesting physics there, but why is that?
At gut scale, we don't expect space-time to break down. We just expect
that. Well, these
perturbations are perturbations that exist in space. Now, they're propagating in space-time. So if you take those perturbations back to an arbitrarily early time in the universe, you're looking at those perturbations when they have a physical size that's smaller than the scale at which we think it makes sense to talk about, you know, the separation between two points in space-time. And so it turns out that the standard calculation ignores that. And so if you put this extra scale in, it says that every given moment is going to become physical, if you like, at some finite time in the past, rather than in the infinite past. And so the key extra ingredient is if the kind of particle physics changes, then that's not going to make any difference, because that particle physics is still happening inside of a well-understood space-time background. As you go through the, say, electro-weak phase transition, you know, particle physics changes a lot. But the physics of space-time doesn't change at all. I mean, the T mu nu part changes, but the G mu nu, the left-hand side of the Einstein equation doesn't.
But you can reproduce all these effects on the CMB using an ordinary modification of the
infinite
scale.
I've thought about that. I think in order to do that in detail, I think would require a highly tuned model of inflation. So you're certainly right that you could
fairly tuned to the
right. But well, no, I think worse tuned. But the point is that
it's where you just take a slightly less
expensive thing. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know you guys have looked at this, but I think the thing is that if you really want to say that you're testing string theory with this, you have to have done the ab initio calculation inside of string theory that lets you predict what the functional form of this correction is, which no one's done as soon. So if you had that calculation, then you can go and look for that particular correction. So just seeing some correction to the spectrum isn't really going to tell you a lot. But to really test a particular model, you have to have the calculation done inside of that model. And that's the thing that's missing from this at the moment.
I agree with you. That's what your aim is, that's string theory.
Yeah.
But the thing is that if you do see something in CMB and you want to then include the
experience in
space time, you know nothing because
there's no. I quite agree. I mean, I think we could argue about which explanation is more natural than the other, but. I mean, yeah. No, you could be. I mean, there's interpretation issues here. There's a very, very big theoretical uncertainty in this calculation. I'm going to say something about it. Okay. Right.
So that would be the thing that I think about.
Okay, I'm going to stop now and take a whole bunch of questions.
Can you give me more time?
Mallet?
Yeah. So your upper bound for the inversion rate scale of that has to be below the GUT gut scale?
Well, around the GUT gut scale. I think it can go up to 10 to the 16 or something like that.
But that's an observational
fact. That's an observational fact. It's no theoretical input at all. It's just a brutal observational fact. We've gone and measured this thing and we haven't found it.
Doesn't have to do with getting rid of particles?
No. And in fact, in general, you don't want, I mean, you have to make sure that there aren't phase transitions happening after inflation. They're going to produce relics that are going to mess the universe up. I mean, that's part of the challenge. I mean, you can get rid of any relic that happened before inflation, but you can't, and once inflation's finished, it won't then suppress relics. I mean, one thing it will do is it can mean that the symmetry breaking happens in a consistent way throughout the universe, so you don't produce any topological defects inside of our visible universe.
Some of the
starting at the Planck mass, yeah. And so the issue with that is that we can only observe a tiny piece of the total inflation of the spectrum. So even if they start at the Planck mass, that's millions of epochs before the present day, and so we only observe the last piece of inflation. I mean, no matter how much inflation there was before it. I mean, this gets back to the point that I said that you have to tune inflationary models very carefully, usually, if you only want to have 60 epochs of inflation. The typical number is that you get some number that's much, much larger than 60 epochs. And this, I mean, these chaotic models are
expensive
to get only 60 epochs.
Yeah.
No, I quite agree. So if you want to fine tune these models so that you don't see this effect, so that all the interesting scales have always been larger than the Planck scale, you can do that. But it's a fine tuning that you've got no physical justification for other than you don't want to deal with this problem. So you and I are in complete agreement.
So now it's a little bit confusing. So you said finish the scale of a scale on the scale of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean the 60 epoch
length? No, 60 epoch length comes from making sure that the universe is almost exactly homogeneous and isotropic today. Right. If the universe, if the amount of inflation and the end inflation happens at the gut scale, or eating happens up to the gut scale, then that's just how close you need, how much inflation you have. Need to take a generic set of initial conditions and drive it so close to a perfectly flat universe that we can't tell it. We can't tell the difference today. So that's a geometrical argument. It's got nothing to do with the.
Right. I understand that.
Yeah.
My question is, so if I allow inflation that has millions of people, we're still, as you said, still at the only the 60.
Yeah.
So is there a constraint on the scale of inflation that inflation has millions of people?
Oh, no. Inflation can start at the Planck scale.
It just has to end at
the gut scale.
So you are saying that this 10 to the 19 on the gut scale, it's a scale which the last 60.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And all the only other thing we're saying is there must have been at least another 10 epochs of inflation or something in order to see
that. It's not really.
No, we don't care about that. Yeah. In fact, the more inflation you have, the better we want it.
But for the fundamental. Constraints here is very important that you put this constraint by saying, ideally, the only way inflation can start at this scale.
Yeah, no, in fact, I think
there is no constraint.
There's no constraint from what we're talking about here. Okay, I think I'm going to press on. Lee's not here to keep us in time. So the next thing is we want to say, well, we've put this. So what we're going to say is we've got these two scales, we've got the Hubble scale, and we've got the scale of new physics. And so just dimensional analysis alone, it's telling us that the impact of this new scale is just going to be the ratio of these two, of those Hubble scale and the new scale, raised to some power. And it turns out that all of this, probably hundreds of papers have been written on this by now. And the key question in all of these papers, in some sense, is that n equals 1 or n equals 2. And so people have looked at different models for this to produce an n equals 2 effect, and that's going to be on the, this number, if we're lucky, is on the order of 100, so 100 squared is something that's unobservable. On the other hand, something that's, if n is equal to 1, we're looking at something that's potentially a 1% effect, and that's something we can talk about observing.
And so, there's actually free scale, because if you have h, then you have an energy in the potential, which mass scale squared above the Planck mass squared.
Right.
So, and you can also get that scale over n, and that's very free.
Okay, no, that's true, yeah. But this is naive dimensional analysis, as opposed to the more sophisticated dimensional analysis.
That's a bigger effect,
right? Right. So we have to worry about this. So in a sense, what's going to follow is an attempt to calculate this number n. So we, as I said, we can't do these calculations ab initio on string theory. No one knows how to do this. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce the minimum length by some unsubs. And what we intend this is a kind of case study of what happens if you have some theory that has this minimum length. We don't intend it as this is what you actually expect to see when you look up the sky. But it turns out that there's two ways that you can introduce a minimum length. One of them is going to modify the evolution equations, and that typically leads to an effect on the order of n equals 2. And the other way is just to modify the initial conditions of these modes, to leave the evolution equations intact. And that typically, when you do it, leads to an effect that gives you n equals 1. I just want to stop to point out and explain that there's some beautiful work, I think, that's been done by Conrad Schaum, by Gary Hsu, by Yantita Vandeschaar, and also by Brian Green. And it takes all of these effects and turns them into some sort of effective field theory approach. So you don't know what the ultraviolet completion is of the kind of Einstein gravity, but you know that whatever it is going to turn on these higher order operators with some coefficients that we don't understand. And so in some sense, I think this lets us quantify what these effects might be using some sort of, it doesn't necessarily need to say what the coefficients are, but it does provide us with a way of kind of consistently organizing what the possibilities are. So I think from a theoretical perspective, I think this is a very promising way of dealing with things. And in their approach, what happens is you take some specific surface inside of your space, and the operators that change the initial conditions live on the surface. And they've shown that these do in fact lead to an n equals 1 effect in terms of the parameterization that I gave on the previous slide. So what we do is we're going to say that the standard calculation for putting in when you actually look at work your way through the gravitational perturbation theory, you get an equation for each mode in the density perturbation, each mode measured in terms of its co-moving wave number k, that looks like this equation here, where the primes are derivatives of the spectral conformal time. And I'm not going to write down what this z is. Z is some complicated function of the background and the evolution of the scalar field. But it turns out that at very early times, that z prime prime over z term vanishes, and what you're left with is just the evolution of the mode in what looks like flat space. And that means that if you allow yourself to continue back to an infinitely far past, which in conformal time is the eta goes to minus infinity, you can just say, well, I'm just living in flat space, which is the argument that you use to set up the Bunch-Davies vacuum. And you can say that the mode has to have this form, this functional form here. But the problem is when you've done, this is just the standard inflationary normalization of the inflationary perturbation spectrum. The problem when you do that, of course, is then you're talking about the physical wavelength of the mode when it was infinitely smaller than the Planck scale, which is obviously something that we don't want to be doing. And so what we've done is that this choice of initial conditions guarantees that you have nice Poisson statistics for these fluctuations, and it's done at arbitrarily small scales. So the way we're going to introduce the minimum length via our answer is simply to say that instead of doing this fixing at very, very small scales, we're going to do this fixing at some finite time in the past for each, and that finite time is obviously going to be different for each mode, because each mode's wavelength is slightly smaller than the previous one. And so we're going to calculate what the critical conformal time is for each mode, and it's going to be the moment at which the wavelength of that mode becomes larger than whatever the minimum length is we're putting in the theory, so one over n, whatever that scale is. And it turns out that you can actually work through this the algebra of this without any difficulty at all. And it turns out that if you have the limit that you're doing to setting these modes at an infinite far past, the C plus parameter there is simply 1, and the C minus parameter is 0, and there's a consistency equation that C plus and C minus together have to observe in order to satisfy the standard bosonic statistics. But it turns out that as you set the initial value of the modes at some finite time, you get the C minus gets turned on with an amplitude that's roughly equal to H over M. And so what we're seeing here is an H over M effect rather than an H over M squared effect. And so what we're saying is, in some sense, the mode is created in Minkowski space, but it's created at a finite time, in other words, a finite length, and then suddenly, as it's created, of course, it feels the expansion of the universe. And so by just taking the lifetime limit of these two Hankel functions, we can extract the power spectrum at late time. And the details are in the third paper that I wrote with Brian and Gary and Conrad. And so we can write down a modulated spectrum, which is what we actually get from this. So the P on the left-hand side is what you get without considering this effect, and the thing in the brackets is this modulation. And so you see that the first piece is you've got H over N, which is some small number plus 1, so you know that this modulation is small. And then just looking at the parameters here, this is giving us the amplitude, that the modulation is coming from the fact that this is sinusoidal. And the phase says that we don't know how to match. We don't know exactly how equation ends, so we don't know how to match a particular scale in the sky to a particular value of k, so we had to put this phase in to parameterize our ignorance of this. And the last piece, of course, is just the 10 to the scatter ratio. And what that's measuring is how fast the value of h is changing, which is in some sense what the 10 to the scatter ratio is sensitive to. And so, in a sense, if the value of h isn't changing at all, then each mode lives in exactly the same universe as its predecessor, and you won't see the spectrum change. But the faster the value of h is changing, the more rapidly the modulation you would expect the modulation to be in k-space. So it turns out because the tensor to scalar ratio is something that's separately observable in the CMB, it means that we've really only got two new free parameters here rather than three new free parameters. This is going to be crucial in morphology.
Ask a question.
Sure. What?
So you said there's a constraint between some plus and minus.
Right.
You show C minus to be a number. Can you choose it to be a function, arbitrary function of
K? Not once you've written down an answer to the initial conditions, you actually work out what that number is for each value of K. I mean, if you don't specify the initial conditions, then obviously it's an arbitrary function. Once you specify the initial conditions, it's a number.
But your initial condition was the C minus being.
No, that's the result of that initial condition. Yeah, it's the result of saying we want this mode to have this form at some finite time in the past rather than the infinitely far past. And then, so this is you just work through a couple of lines of algebra and get that. So this is the modulated spectrum that we're just to show what this, I mean, it's a plot with the bulk suppressed, so it's actually a much smaller modulation than it appears. And this, in fact, is just a slowly decaying modulation for a particular, for p equals 100, in other words, and the universe is. That's expanding as a power law with p equals 100, and a tensor to scalar ratio of 0.01 and an h over n of 100. So as we expect, if we change h, we can see how this modulation, we change the way that the tensor to scalar ratio varies, we can watch this modulation, the form of this modulation change. What? H over n, m over h is 100, yeah. Sorry, I'm getting that talk. We use that slide more than once, and we haven't learned. So we can then feed this initial spectrum into CMB class, and we can see what this does to the C sub L. And we see that typically we've got some complicated and messy change in the spectrum, because this modulation of the spectrum is then being kind of convolved with everything else that happens in the sky, in particular the acoustic peaks. So we don't see a clean signal in the spectrum, even though we started out with a clean signal in the CMB spectrum, even though we did start out with a clean signal in the primordial spectrum. So I just want to now talk about what we've done computationally. So we actually want to see, well, given this kind of case study, which we think its overall properties are reasonable because it depends on h in a way that we would expect, even if the actual kind of numerical parameters that are in there, we don't know how to compute. So we actually said, well, let's assume that the universe really has this modulation. How good a job could we do of extracting that from a perfect data set?
But you may also think that the effects of this sort of planet finite
length,
say, may break
the
isotropy of the matrix.
Pardon?
May break the isotropy of the matrix.
These perturbations in general are anisotropic. They're anisotropic on the average, but they're anisotropic for detail.
Yeah, but dependency on k, the absolute value, maybe depending on the direction of k.
Right. That's something we haven't even thought about. Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of second order development beyond what we were.
No, because
that's basically
the
fact
that you need
to be well, we can talk about that later. In this. So we're looking at so what we did is we generated synthetic CMB data sets that didn't have the signal in, and then looked to see if we actually did the fit, assuming the signal was there, how tightly can we constrain the parameters to describe this population? And we looked at what people who are familiar with the CMB will know is just a hopelessly optimistic data set. We assume we have cosmic variance limited and noise free out to a value of L equals 2000, which is like many orders of magnitude better than what anyone's managed to do so far. We assume that the central values for all of the parameters are the ones that are the central values from W now. And we looked at both the temperature and isotropy, but also the cross correlation between temperature and the E mode of polarization. The E mode of polarization with itself and the B mode of polarization with itself, which are all things that you can measure by looking at the sky. We allow all of the left-hand parameters to float, because if you don't allow all the parameters to float, it turns out that if you don't marginalize over all of the parameters that can change, it turns out that you're going to get an overly optimistic sense of how well you can measure any of the parameters that you are allowed to change. So we can't just look at how what happens when we change the parameters that describe the modulation. We also have to, kind of redo the work that W method, but with all of the parameters and variance. So we vary the spectral index, the running of the spectral index, the tensor to scalar ratio, and the transplanting parameters, plus things like the Hubble constant. And it turns out that what happens when we do that is because of this modulated spectrum, we actually see that there are multiple peaks in the likelihood space. And that means that the job of actually extracting where the kind of sender is the most likely piece of likelihood space actually gets tougher because of that. So it made the problem much harder. And we looked at this firstly with a Fisher matrix calculation, then with a grid search, and finally we did the proper thing with these Monte Carlo Markov chains, which is a state-of-the-art for cosmological parameter estimation. And so the Markov chain results, what I'm going to focus on. So the Fisher matrix, the problem with that is if you computed at a point in parameter space, and it's already been critiqued in the case where you have these multiple peaks in likelihood space, there's well-known problems with that. And of course, the grid search is simply too low with too many, when you have lots of parameters that you're changing, because you have the cost of a grid search goes exponentially with the number of parameters. But the Markov chains are fast, they're linear with the number of parameters, they're well understood, and they're essentially the standard tool in CMB physics today. But it turns out this is a computationally demanding problem, because actually computing the CMB spectrum with this small-scale structure and the primordial spectrum turns out as a much tougher job than computing the CMB in the standard case, but by roughly an order of magnitude of CPU time. And plus, we have to allow for these parameterized likelihood space. So the job, in some ways, is a couple of orders of magnitude harder than the usual 50-degree cosmological data. But we did. And so what happened is because of this dependence on the scalar to tensor ratio, which is something that which depends on H. We did the case we did the calculation for a case where H turns out to have a high value, in other words, one that would be detectable with Plankton, where it has a low value, where it would be essentially undetectable even with this data set. And so for the high value of H, because as you remember, H corresponds to epsilon, which is one of the three parameters in the modulated spectrum, it turns out we can do a much, much better job of constraining any potential modulation if we've got an independent measurement of H. And so in this case, you can see that we can get a 2-sigma, the actual value of H over M in our data set is 0. In other words, we've assumed that the signal's not there at all. But it means that if we could actually get in this data set, we could actually constrain H over M to be on the order of about half of 1%, in other words, to a 2-sigma level of confidence, which is a comparatively, is a very, 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 very strong constraint given what one normally manages to from cosmological data sets. On the other hand, as I said, we looked at all of the possible things that can vary. The one up in the corner is the variance of the way that the running changes relative to the spectral index. And the little islands you see there are just a product of the way that we've plotted the plotting program we're using. Whereas the larger island, as I said, the second one down on the right-hand one on the second level down, that island in the likelihood space is in fact real, and that's part of what made the problem just tough from a technical point of view. But you can see in these, and again, the phase here is unconstrained. You can take any value between pi and minus pi, which is what we expect, because we've said that the signal isn't in our simulated data set, so we don't expect to be able to constrain the phase. And the constraints we can put in H over M are in the third level down here. So you can see that for all of the different parameters we're considering, H over M typically has to be less than half of 1% at the 2-sigma confidence level.
Sorry, Richard, again, so what happens
to
the second parameter?
And we're essentially varying all of the baryon, photon ratio, we had actually 10 parameters that we varied. I'm not sure I can remember all of them off the top of my head. The current value of the cosmological constant, the current amount of dark energy, the current amount of dark matter, the number of neutrino species, I think we left fixed. The standard set of parameters you'd vary if you're doing this sort of thing. And we had weak wavelength turned on in the same detail.
Sorry, what are all the other ones there? I'm having a hard time.
Yeah, so this is actually shows more clearly in the paper. The top one is considering variance with respect to the so-called running of the running. It's the way that the scalar index changes as a function of k, which is something that you can measure. The next one down is looking at 16e, which is 16 epsilon, which is essentially h during inflation, as a function of, on the bottom one, the scalar spectral index in d and d log k. The next one down is looking at the H over M, this parameter, the parameter that determines the size of this modulation. These different parameters. The next one down is the phase of the modulation. And the last one is the overall amplitude of the modulation, which is again something of the perturbations, which is again something you can measure from the CMB. So I mean, this figure is lifted from our paper, but it's more just the key thing to take away from it is really the third line. We see that the H over M is constrained at the two signal level to be within about half, be less than half of 1% of the simulated data set. In other words, the actual value is zero, but we can say with 95% confidence that the measured value would be less than 0.005. Another way of saying that is if the real universe has a larger value than that, then we'll be able to detect it.
So that anything depends very sensitively on the H over M.
And on the value of
half the line.
Yeah, it depends.
That's a really for sure. We don't understand what H over M is.
Exactly. The thing that we knew that going into this just from this dimensional analysis argument. What we didn't know was that everything also depends very sensitively on epsilon, what people had previously realized, because that in some sense takes one parameter out of the modulation to put it. So what I want to show now is just the converse to this. So this is a plot for H over M, for R is a couple of orders of magnitude smaller, in other words, a much lower scale of inflation. In other words, H over M is now on the order of 0.001, or H rather is much lower. And see, here now we can only constrain H over M to be less than 0.06. In other words, an order of magnitude weaker constraint than we managed in the case where we had an independent measurement of the value of H from the tensor mode. And so again, I can show the same plot. I'm going down into a lot of detail, but what I hope you can see from this is that the allowed region of parameter space suddenly gets a lot larger, simply because we have to now measure three parameters from the modulation alone, because we haven't been able to independently constrain the tensor. So the take-home message from this is if you have a large value of H, irrespective of the value of H over M, you expect to be able to do a much better job of constraining this sort of modulation.
So the tensor on the waveform of the third region, or is it really just the overall size?
I think fun.
If
it doesn't have a wavy form, you'd have a different. I mean, all you do is lift it up or lift it down by some amount. Then you'll never see that, because all that's going to do is renormalize the overall amplitude of the spectrum. I think less sensitive, because we're actually seeing several perturbations inside of the window that we're looking at. I mean, that would be very hard to tell from just some change in power as a function of k. The fact that it goes down and then comes up again is something crucial here. No, it's also that the phi is going out to very large values here. I mean, it's a messy parameter degeneracy. It's not really telling us anything. Given that on the other one you're constrained to live inside of this region here, whereas now you're constrained to live inside of this much larger region here. So the constraint is actually weaker if you took out experience. The other thing I want to show is just to look at the way that we can recover the parameters. So these are the parameters that we put in, these are the parameters that we got out. So in other words, all of the other parameters have not been changed. So even if this modulation was there, there's nothing degenerate with the other parameters that we're considering. So if there was some degeneracy between the modulation we've put in and the other parameters that we were measuring, we would expect to see that we had either a large uncertainty on one of these things, or simply that the central value had shifted. That hasn't happened, which is a sign that we're looking at something sensible. Last thing, I don't know if I want to get into this in detail here, but these islands in parameter space are a real effect. I first seen in a previous paper that looked at a smaller set of parameters by Okamoto and Lim, and this is a problem for the Monte Carlo analysis, because it means that your chains get trapped on one of these islands and they can't then hop back out again. So it takes a long time for the chains to converge. We hope that a multi-parameter fit would smear them out. Then we saw them again, and then we went back and we could understand these islands as being a kind of beating from the way that as you change the parameters of the oscillations, it turns out that you get two measured likelihoods for different parameter values that are essentially the same, which means you see these disconnected islands in likelihood space. Now, details again are in our paper, so I won't go into it here, but we can write it down in a semi-analytical way, just using this modulated form of the spectrum. You can see how this works out. And so in some sense, the islands correspond to, as you slice across this region here, you've got a series of stripes where you're looking at something that has a value of 1, even though which corresponds to a good fit. even though when you actually look at the likelihood, you see something that's oscillating down to the other. So the people who are interested in the CMB, I'm mentioning that as a byproduct of what we've done. It's not that interested if you're interested in string theory. The last thing I want to talk about is just to sum up where we've gone. I've seen a lot of questions, so we have a little bit of time to start at the end. But what we've done is tried to probe a possible generic effect of string theory and quantum gravity or cosmology. In other words, that we expect that the description of space-time in terms of a nice, Einstein, well-defined metric that's described by Einstein gravity is going to break down at some point due to some sort of higher-order correction. We only see this as a feasibility study. We don't see this as a detailed calculation of what string theory or anything else really predicts. It's simply what we might be able to do if we had a full ab initio calculation inside of one of these theories. And what it does is it tells us that the problem is worth closer inspection, because at least there's a region of parameter space in which it's conceivable that we could be living, where in the future you could actually go and measure this effect. It's telling us that the effect is an a priori tiny. Let's look at the next thing. We wouldn't say that you should go and spend billions of dollars doing a measurement of the CMB just on the strength of this calculation alone. And I'm absolutely serious about this. On the other hand, people are going to be spending billions of dollars doing measurements of the CMB, whether we do this calculation or not. And so this is potentially something that if you're going to measure the CMB, this kind of calculation, once the theoretical uncertainties are under control, is something that you'll get for free. In other words, it's something you don't have to spend any money to get other than some theorist time, which is obviously cheap compared to a satellite. And so this is something that I think people who are thinking in terms of mission design and what you might be able to get out of CMB measurements seem to be thinking about, especially since the theoreticians have like a 10-year lead time to really understand this problem properly. So as I said, we're doing these observations anyway. There's a bunch of these are just a tiny sample of this new missions that are currently on the drawing board that people are thinking about in the CMB in the top line. And also it turns out that any measurement that you do of the sky that in the end is going to recover the primordial spectrum of perturbations, and that includes measurements of kind of galaxy clustering and light and alpha forest, that's also going to be sensitive to this effect in the end, and it's going to let you tighten the constraints on that. I didn't consider that in the previous calculations that I showed, but in principle that lets you constrain, by putting priors from other experiments, it lets you constrain the measurements of the CMB more tightly. So the impact of the minimum length is going to be small for any reasonable parameter choice. In other words, the kind of gross picture that we get from the standard inflationary calculations is biased, at least at the 1% level. On the other hand, it tells us that streaming effects are in some sense closer to the surface in cosmology problems than they are in particle physics. And at the same time, the basic inflationary predictions are safe, which in some ways is the best of all possible worlds, because we don't want to find some effect that's going to completely ruin everything we know about inflation, but at the same time, we don't want to find that the effect is so tiny that we're never going to observe it. So this is potentially a nice place for us to be living. And the results depend, as I said, the results depend on the assumptions about initial conditions and about the overall model. But everyone agrees that H over M is a key parameter, and so the argument is over what the exponent and feedback should be. And as I said at the beginning, I think the effective string theory approach that's going on here is a powerful tool. And ongoing work, something we're thinking about at the moment, is that you can say, given the operators that you can turn on an effective field theory, what you expect those to do to the spectrum. And so one of the things that we can potentially do, once that's better under control, I know that Gary and Conrad, who will be here next week, are thinking about that, are actually working on this calculation at the moment. In principle, we could take the corrections that they're going to predict in a lot of sort of operators and run this process again and see how it is that we could constrain the prefactors for these operators that show up an effective field theory, how tightly we can constrain them by doing cosmological measurements in the same way that we've done here. And so I think that's where I want to end this up. It's lunchtime. And the good thing is to roll his chair to take some further questions.
Well, I can't resist getting in. So this is a fairly common sense that a more prosaic framework when you do all these calculations would be to take a solid with a magnetic field and you measure the lambda levels, and then you dial the magnetic field down and all lambda levels will come down in the same way. That's what we have to do for very small physics there.
Right.
But in a very, you have to spend billions of dollars to move them up. And I want to tell you, what typically goes on there is that you don't get these very detailed answers on short distance physics, because it essentially comes down to an issue of the battery process. Mm-hmm. Either really fast or really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that's consistent with what you're saying, that you would be very nice.
that there's a breakdown of data that this is what we're doing. I think it is. I think one of the interesting things that came out of this is that if you imagine the corrections that you're making to the perturbations are in some sense applied adiabatically. Cases where you can do that, you typically tend to see an n equals 2 effect rather than n equals 1 effect. So in some sense, we could associate this with we can associate this effect, I think, with something that corresponds to a breakdown of adiabaticity in the way that the perturbations are actually produced, and that they sort of make, there's a kind of sharp discontinuity at the point where they're produced, and then they just propagate normally. Whereas if you change things in an adiabatic way, what tends to happen is, I think, that you tend to see things that are h over n squared effects rather than h over n. I think that corresponds to what you're saying. We're assuming that that things change sharply on the initial condition surface, but don't change apart from that. And I think that corresponds to seeing that things are non-adiabatic. I think that's analogous. And the other question is the thing that worries me about this is you don't know whether the initial condition surface is in some sense fuzzy. If you make that surface fuzzy, then to some extent I think you'll smear out the signal. I don't think that's something that's well understood at the moment. Like, you're not, you know, the thing doesn't become classical at exactly the Planck length or the minimum length. It becomes classical in some slightly more, you know, probabilistic way.
The polar
I think in the end it gets back to the fact that the only piece of inflation we see is the last 60 or 70 epochs. And so people who want to do a turn on inflation, we typically find that the energy scale, which the quantum fluctuations which go like h, are bigger than the driving force from the classical slope of the potential, the semi-classical slope of the potential. Those are typically at much higher scales than where you expect the end of inflation to be. So typically what you see in these internal inflation models is that you have a stochastic phase, and then a region of the universe will leave that stochastic phase as it fluctuates downwards suddenly, and then it will evolve in a semi-classical way. So all the piece of the inflaton potential that we actually have observational access to is almost certainly dominated by the semi-classical evolution of the inflaton rather than by the stochastic evolution.
So it must be an act of God that it's such a
No, I think you've got it completely the wrong way around. Inflation can last as long as you want in one of these internal models. But the last, we need to have e to the 60, but it doesn't matter if we have more. And so the way you need an act of God is to have only e to the 60. And in that sense, say, inflationary models where you want to very carefully tune the perturbation spectrum to cut off at large scales. I'm not sure about the point that Lee was making about the Portsmouth group, but certainly calculations that I've seen that have done that seem to have some tuning buried in somewhere. Alternatively, you want to arrange for inflation to produce a universe that's almost flat, but not exactly flat in the spatial sense. Then again, that needs the same kind of tuning. And those models would need some sort of active God. Whereas a model that has an infinite amount of inflation, or semi-infinite amount of inflation, then all we can see is like the 60, and that doesn't need an active God at all.
The minimum features.
Yeah, but to be close to that minimum requires an active God, because you can be anything above that. But that doesn't have any impact on this.
Ben Skimmer, this is last year, you should be worried about the back reaction.
We haven't thought about it a lot in the context of this calculation. We believe naively that it's under control. I actually think that the person to ask about that is Gary and Connor. Their effective field theory, this effective field theory approach, I think, gives you much better control of the fact reaction, because that actually gives you a consistent framework to do a calculation. Whereas this is in some ways much more heuristic. I mean, something that was done a couple of years ago. So I think. I mean, what we've done that's new is the kind of fits the simulated data. That was what we were doing last summer. And so I think the question of back reaction is better posed in the context of the predictive field theory, because that actually gives you a framework to do a calculation. And that's that I know is an active area of research at the moment, but it's not something that we've thought about a lot. That was our belief at the time, and it's nice to see it confirmed by them. I mean, that was our belief at the time when we did this calculation, and it's nice to see it confirmed by this. But I think an effective field theory calculation where you're considering all of the possible operators that can be turned on is obviously better than simply this is very much putting in an effect by hand just on the basis of our kind of gut feeling about the way that the minimum length might show up in the early universe. It's not it's something that's, you know, we've derived intuitively rather than on the basis of the detailed calculation. Whereas if you're doing it in the effective field theory context, up to the fact that you don't know what the parameters are, you are, in fact, you're doing a real calculation that you have some control over. But, you know, this doesn't, this is less constrained.
Okay, very short. If you observe any degeneracy in the parameter space with this ratio H over
N, I mean... If you have a very long, you know, if you imagine that the modulation has a very long wavelength in K-space, then there's a degeneracy because all you're doing is lifting, you know, the spectrum up or down relative to where it would otherwise have been. And that just renormalizes the scale of the perturbation spectrum slightly. And because you don't know a priori what the scale of the perturbation spectrum was, then you can't tell that it's been changed slightly. So then there would be a degeneracy. But as long as you can see, you know, as long as you have this oscillation, then it's very hard to imagine a genuine degeneracy because there's nothing else in the primordial spectrum that looks like that. Other than, unless you choose some very whacked out inflation model. So
it's just
but in general, in some limit, that parameter will become degenerate. This parameter will become degenerate with other things. But in the limit, but in general, the answer is no. You know, there's no. The fact that we could recover the original parameter values, so you know, we didn't see any degeneracy. If there were any degeneracies there, the Monte Carlo searches that we've done would have found them because the Monte Carlo. Process doesn't start with any priors about what's degenerate. So if it turns out you have a degeneracy you don't know about, you would see one of those islands in the parameter space is going to extend off in the direction of the degeneracy. And then the Monte Carlo chain would just walk out, you know, would just walk through the probability likelihood space until it finds it. And so then, and in some ways, we don't have to do that calculation by hand because you know, the Monte Carlo process does it for us. But on the other hand, we can certainly understand that result intuitively.
That's how we replace the
lowest
node. And
since,
like, virtually disciplined about lunch, I don't think we should really try to change the paradigm for fun. But if we can aim for half an hour plus, that would actually be good. That would take us to. Well, we can aim for half an hour, and then if it's half that, then so please right here in the down hall. So I'm going to record it again here.
You can't go away. You could leave another class.
Well, you're right, Dad. We can't. Between now and then, I'll see if I can find a room there.
Third floor.
Down the road. So if schedule slides from more than half an hour, I'll put a sign up where the other room would be, but we go downstairs from here, essentially.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, it's not funny. I heard a question was okay. I didn't feel like I made it up.
Yeah,
well, I heard it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not sure.
I heard it
was
lacking.
Well, I'm just going to say.